All right, back on the record, January 10th, 2025, 10:45 a.m. on the Meadowview Consolidated Administrative Appeals and Preliminary Plat and Conditional Use Permit applications. Mr. Telgen was just questioning Dr. Rosine right in the middle of that, so we'll let him continue. Go ahead, Mr. Telgen. Oh, and I should say, we'll go on for another hour till 11:45, take a 15, then go from noon till 1, and at that point, take our lunch hour. So,
Okay. So, Dr. Rosine, before the break, we were talking about the context of this project, and in particular, we were talking about the sort of historical context of impacts on the Island Lake Aquifer. And you had mentioned that there was this 30-year history of impacts requiring, I guess, supplementation of water into the lake. Do we know sort of generally what has caused or contributed to that 30-year history of impacts?
Sure. So the answer is kind of two part, yes and no. We understand generally why it's happening. Surface water groundwater interactions are always complex. There are have been a bunch of aquifer or water supply studies done, and I believe there's another one pending, which will hopefully add shed some light to it. But what we do know, is sort of incontrovertible here, is that the impervious cover in the area has increased a lot. So what that means is just that the area has developed a lot, and this has really happened over a period of 30 years. And why that's important is because the Island Lake really doesn't have any large inlets, so it's going to be primarily fed from really two ways: immediate runoff into it, so small streams run off from the shore, areas like that, shallow groundwater interflow contribution, and direct water precip onto it. We know we have all sorts of outwash sands and glacial tills that are creating different lenses, and even when we think we know those things, we often, only know so much. It's a little bit of like the elephant in the dark room. It depends on which side you're poking at. Some of the studies have lended a fair amount of insight into it, which is it's not really well understood whether the aquifer directly supports it or whether, if it's below or above. But what we do know is that a depleted aquifer around it will either cause the lake to lose more, or potentially will directly cause the lake to be fed less. Right, so that means either its losses will increase or its recharge will decrease. If that made any sense.
Yeah, no, thank you so much. And you had so then that discussion of the historical context overlapped with you talking about impervious surfaces increasing. Yes.
Correct. Yeah.
So can you tell me about sort of the role of impervious surfaces in watershed health?
Okay, so this is one of the biggest advancements in stormwater management, and it's really been going on for the past 15 or so years. And really, what we're referring to is kind of the seminal paper referring to the impervious cover model. It came out of the Center for Watershed Protection, and what it does is it directly relates stream health to levels of impervious cover. So what we know is that, you asked me in the beginning, what is it that I study? And it's water resources. And we know that water goes typically one of two places. It's either rainwater comes down and either goes off in the form of surface water, or it goes down into the ground in the form of aquifer or groundwater, aquifer recharge. So it's either infiltrating or it's running off. And that is that component, the degree of runoff, as it relates to impervious cover, is the principal cause of declines in water quality. So what does that bring us to? It brings us to advanced stormwater management that relies heavily on infiltration and filtration mechanisms. And that is very simply because in terms of best management practices or BMPs, nothing compares with infiltration and biofiltration BMPs. It's just it essentially eliminates or drastically reduces the water quality impacts, and then the attendant things when we talk about stream health, the infiltration and base flow is essential with that. So I'm sorry if that's getting too esoteric here, but yeah, it's a cycle, right? It's how much is going in surface water, how much is going in the groundwater. The more that you put on in the form of surface water, the greater the decline in stream health, because its streams are no longer being fed in terms of base flow.
And you had mentioned a model that looked at this.
That's right. It's called the impervious cover model.
Okay.
It's not a model that I built. Yes, that's
fair
right.
Enough. Yeah. And I'm showing, exhibit A79, page 2. Can you explain what we're looking at here?
Right. So this is perfect here. So what you see here on the vertical axis, so the one going up and down here, on the bottom of it, so vertical axis is stream quality. So that's essentially a measure of watershed health. On the bottom of the axis, it's poor quality. On the top of the axis, it's excellent water quality. And then this figure is further subdivided going across.
Is vertical right here. Excellent. Yeah. And the poor.
I'm sorry. I've drank a lot of coffee today. I'll slow down. And then to the left, the orange there, that's in the sensitive region. And so let's talk about what the horizontal axis is. So that's impervious cover. So that's how many rooftops, how many parking lots, things of that sort that are unmanaged in terms of infiltration exist in a watershed. And what you can see is that when you have zero impervious cover, you have excellent watershed health. And these are real figures. All those points on there are actual watersheds that have been measured, and they measure it in terms of aquatic biointegrity. And then what we see is when we begin to hit about a 5% measure, we begin to see that sort of a measurable impact. Then we transition at 10%, we go into the impacted range. And then at about 25%, we hit the not supporting range. And then about 60%, we hit the urban drainage range. So you might remember early on in our conversation here, we talked about how literally almost every surrounding stream, all the significant surrounding streams around here in the Silverdale area are in this non-supporting range. And that's simply, it's not unique to Silverdale in this area. It's all around the country, but old school stormwater management that doesn't provide for infiltration results in this. This, another way to think of this figure, this is a history of retention ponds, right? This is a history of retention ponds. We've been doing retention ponds since we started managing for flooding long ago, but retention ponds contribute very little to water quality.
And explain that, because we've been talking about groundwater recharge, and we started this conversation with you talking about the importance of groundwater recharge to watershed health and to water quality and to that sort of thing. And then you just said this is a history of retention ponds.
Right.
Can you explain the connection between those ideas in your mind?
Right. So retention ponds, are great. They're a great best management practice, and I'm not trying to suggest that we don't need them. But the use of retention ponds rose out of flooding, and the need to have a controlled release rate out of ponds. But they really represent or out off a development, but they really represent sort of old school stormwater management. They can still be done okay, but it's by no means is it modern stormwater management. Or I shouldn't say modern, by no means is it advanced stormwater management, because we still see a lot of them in use. But what a pond does is it holds the water, right? Remember, if you have a parking lot, that landscape would have previously, especially in Washington State, would have infiltrated probably almost every drop of water that hit the surface. Then in a parking lot setting or a rooftop setting, most of that is going to run off. It's captured in curbs and pipe, and that goes into a pond. The ponds are not designed to infiltrate. So what they do is they hold the water and slowly release it. So remember that continuum I was telling you about, the amount of water that runs off versus the amount of water that goes in the ground. You're greatly increasing the amount of water that runs off. Now you're controlling the rate, but you're not managing the volume. And we'll talk about this a bit later on when we talk about sort of Kitsap County code and the need for both rate, which is how fast, like cubic feet per second, versus volume, which is like gallons or cubic feet or something like that. So when you use infiltration systems, you basically you flatten this curve, because now you can have a parking lot or a rooftop that's putting water back into the ground, and it's cooling the water, it's cleaning the runoff, and you don't have this disruption to the hydrologic cycle. And if we get back to your very first question about context and the MDNS determination, context is everything, right? So the local context is really important here, because as the geology studies that we've seen demonstrate, we have a large amount of sands in the upper portion of it. And then as we get closer down to Barker Creek, they begin to thin out. So what that's basically telling us is the water's going into the ground, it's hitting that lens that's below it, and slowly emerging down in the form of base flow in either the stream or the lake. And that whole process is now going to be disrupted. It's going to go into a pond, boop, and out into the stream.
Got it. So maintaining the groundwater recharge through infiltration is important.
Yeah. Yeah. It's the core element of low impact development. It's in the front of the King County storm, Kitsap County stormwater manual. It is modern day stormwater management, of which for MetaView, there's very little.
Fair enough. And so I do want, because I know there's a lot of topics that you and I are going to talk about, including more on water quality, things like that. But we're trying to get through hydrogeological issues, impacts that really affect sort of the amount of water going into the aquifer, that sort of thing up front, so that we can accommodate our schedule today. So the past historical context has been a stressed aquifer, yes?
Correct.
Going back 30 years.
Correct.
Mm-hmm. And then so we've prepared this other exhibit. This is exhibit A55. And can you tell me what we are looking at here?
Right. So here you're looking at approximately 40 years worth of land use change around Island Lake. And so to the right, that sort of low resolution aerial photo, you can see that much of Island Lake in this instance is surrounded by a green area. There's few homes. The red circle is the approximate aquifer boundary that was identified in one of the studies, either the 89 study or the 91 study. But you can see, if that is the boundary, that a good portion of that area is directly contributing to Island Lake in the form of infiltration and groundwater recharge. Then if you go to the left, that is the 2024 aerial image. And you can see that, there's been an explosion of impervious cover in this area, which is to be expected, right? This beautiful area, people move in, everybody wants to live in these areas. What we know is that the vast majority of that stormwater management that's been conducted is old school. It's either no stormwater management or it's retention ponds. And that is what's contributed to the non-supporting features that we talked about in the surrounding areas. And it's not by accident that you see this supporting stretch below Island Lake is surrounded by woods. Largely undeveloped areas. So it is that area the runoff is either, there we go. So it's going in, the water's entering the ground. Some of it might be running off, but the vast majority of it is infiltrating, recharging, and then emerging as stream base flow or supplying the lake.
Fair enough. And so has this development over the past 30 or 40 years that we see in this comparison? Has this also contributed to the stresses on the aquifer?
Oh, 100%. Oh, yeah, it is. Yeah, no question. So, generally speaking, it's happening for one of three reasons, right? It's going to be water withdrawal. So maybe somebody's pumping it out to drink it, right? It's going to be lack of recharge. And then that lack of recharge has two elements to it, either the amount of impervious cover, right? You're sealing off the top of the aquifer, so it can't be recharged, or decreasing rainfall. And so we do see some of that, but these tend to go in long trends. So I'm not actually that familiar with the long-term precip trends here, but I don't think we're in a realm of where we have a long-term decline. I think they tend to go in large seasonal or multi-year trends, maybe 5, 6, 7 year trends of down, 5, 6, 7 year trends of up. So it would be in my estimate here, and it would take some more study. And hopefully this next study that's coming out is going to talk about that. How much of this has to do with dry years or cumulative dry years.
But I mean, even with dry years and cumulative dry years, I mean, do you find it unusual? You said that they're pumping millions of gallons of water into this lake. Does that just suggest a?
Oh yeah.
Or is that related to development?
Yeah, that's I mean, in my experience, that's fairly unusual, right? 30 million gallons, a year. It's a lot of water, and right. To put it in context, what is the size of this lake? I think it's about 40 acres, so it's not that big of a lake. And the area, what's the size of the development? The size of the proposed development, Meadowview, is 56 acres.
Right. And so you had talked about this area as being important because it's sort of relatively undeveloped. Is that right?
That's right. That's right.
And
it's especially important for Barker Creek, right? Because that's the headwaters to Barker Creek, but a portion of it's flowing for sure into Island Lake too.
Right. And so I mean, we can sort of outline that through just sort of looking at the land. That's the rough project site right there. Does that strike you as a pretty big project taking up?
And Mr. Talgen, I think you should add the approximate area of the ponds.
Oh,
because the ponds are not no impact. The footprint that are the ponds now is a recharge area. Right. So those ponds are large. Those ponds are quite large. So those ponds may as well be paved. I mean, not really, but you know what I'm saying? Like in terms of recharge, the water's not going into the ground. It's falling on a pond. It's capturing it. And then it's coming out in a pipe. So yeah, I mean, this is significant. And then we learned yesterday that was new news to me, that there's a new project that we're not considering, that's to the east. So, I mean, I think you can say with a high degree of confidence that unless really good stormwater management is implemented here, the future of Barker Creek is going to go the same way as everything around it.
So we talked about the historical context, a history of stress over the past 30 years, and a significant amount of stress requiring millions of gallons of water to be pumped into the lake. Now, geographic context. Geographic context. Does this look like a sort of? I mean, is this significant geographically? The size of this project and its location.
Sure. Right. I mean, we have a 56-acre site that is a greater footprint than the lake itself, and the thought that. Yeah. I mean, there's no question, right? And then you have. So you have the multitude of issues here that we're dealing with. You have both the recharge issues, you have the surface water discharge to the stream issues, and then you have also issues that you've touched on, I haven't mentioned yet, which is, you know, the potential addition of 800 residents to a lightly used pond, lightly used lake, right? And that we don't really have a plan for how that's being managed. There's, you know, we have a recreational area that's a short distance from a lake.
I'm going to stop you because we do want to get to the hydrogeological stuff, save okay. other things.
Sure.
But from a hydrogeological perspective, is this a significant geographical context?
Absolutely. I mean, to think otherwise is, yeah, I mean, it's, yeah, no question. It's larger than the lake area. It's got to be significant.
Fair enough. So we've talked about how recharging the groundwater is important. What kind of stormwater management are they using for this project?
They're using ponds, which are, you know, they're not on our list for the most important forms of stormwater management. They're not on the list in the for the Kitsap County Stormwater Manual list approach. They're not an infiltration or biofiltration system. And then they use bio swales on the bottom of the site in the essentially as a polisher to the ponds, in probably the worst place to put them, because we don't have good soils here. So we can do minimal infiltration, but their bioretention systems are designed as underdrained systems. So there's no infiltration. You have a pond that doesn't infiltrate. You have a bioretention system that's not designed to infiltrate. And then you have a little bit of dispersion trenches on the upper reaches. And that little bit just doesn't compensate. And it's very unfortunate, because what we do know is that the upper half of the site has very, very good sandy soils that would be ideal for infiltration. And I think, to me, one of the most salient take homes of this is big projects like this have the opportunity to be a real asset for a community, right? We have 50 years of stormwater management in the area that has resulted in a lot of the problems we're dealing with water budgets. They can very easily design systems that can put water back into the ground at a rate that's higher than what it does in a pre-development condition, and probably at a cost that's less than with ponds. It's not uncommon that low impact development is less costly than the conventional pipe and pond. You know, pipe is very expensive. Curb is very expensive.
Fair enough. But if they're not doing infiltration for most of the site, what would you anticipate the effect of a project like this in terms of groundwater recharge?
There's no question it would go down, because what you've shown here in yellow, and then you could, I know it's not the project that we're talking about here, but if you were to do the same thing to the right, which we don't need to do, but imagine that whole green area now becomes ponds, ponds, ponds. This is the headwaters of Barker Creek. So you're having a dramatic impact on the recharge and base flow element of Barker Creek.
Fair enough. Yeah. So let's to go back a little bit to where we were. Just one second here. To go back to the definition of significant, if we go back and we say a significant impact means a reasonable likelihood of more than a moderate adverse impact on environmental quality, and that involves context and intensity, we know that there's a 30-year history of stress on the aquifer. We know that the project site's bigger than the lake itself. We know that the project site is in the headwaters of Barker Creek, in an area that's important to that creek, given that it's some of the last remaining areas around it that are undeveloped. And we know that they're not using really infiltration. Based on that, can we look at this and apprise ourselves? Is there a reasonable likelihood of more than moderate adverse environmental impacts here?
Yeah, no, I would go a big step beyond that and say there's a near certainty that with what's proposed here, that the that there will be substantial declining health in Barker Creek, especially with the neighboring project that's going to be coming into. But I mean, this issue, this project alone, we don't even have to consider that project. Yeah, no question about it. It's not by accident that this 8,000, 9,000 foot stretch of stream that is still a high quality stream exists there. It's not by accident. It's because it's groundwater fed, and it's large, and there's no large stormwater runoff sources in that area because of the undeveloped. That isn't to say that stormwater is not getting there. Of course it is, but they have these enormous vegetated buffers that are the undeveloped areas.
And what about in terms of aquifer recharge?
Yeah, I mean, I think I've tried to be really clear about this. There is a how do I want to put this? There is a continuum of water, right? And the question just is, where's the water going? Is it going in the ground or is it going off in the form of runoff? This project does not design for infiltration, with a very small exception of a small number of homes on the north side for the use of dispersion trenches. So that tells you that the 56 acres are running off in a form of surface water. That water then does not contribute to the local context of aquifer recharge. So while, so it does not contribute to the local context. So it's important to think about it immediately. We don't want to think about it as how much does this represent standing over the lake, or how much does this think about it stand reflecting Clear Creek. We want to think about, what does this mean in the quarter mile, in the 8,000 feet that is Barker Creek, that is that near shoreline area in Island Lake.
Fair enough. Now, earlier, we heard from Mr. Gurney. I was asking him questions about this stuff. And you heard him say that there was originally some comments by him, I guess, that there should be a hydrological study of the impacts on the Island Lake aquifer on Barker Creek and Island Lake. Now, go with me for a moment. Assume for a moment that under SEPA, the goal of SEPA is to evaluate and analyze and then disclose environmental impacts. Is that something that should have been required, in your opinion, in order to do that?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, no question about it.
And then he said, well, that he leaned on or relied upon, or maybe not him, but the county as a whole would have leaned on or relied upon maybe the stormwater code to take care of these issues. And he didn't know quite if the stormwater code addressed this. But I just want to ask you, have you reviewed the drainage report for this project?
I have, yes.
And did it address recharge issues?
It did not.
Okay. Are you aware of any other information that you've seen that addresses recharge issues with this project?
No.
And so, again, sitting here today, based on just the history, the geography, and how this project is designed, is there a reasonable likelihood of more than moderate impacts?
100%. Yeah. I'd say there's a near certainty it will have dramatic impacts.
Fair enough. I have no further questions at this time for Mr. Rosine.
Okay, Ms. Kolskova, any cross?
Yes, if I might just thank you. If I might just have a moment, I'm finishing typing one question. Thank you,
Mr. Telgen. Could you, Mr. Telgen, could you show the aerial that compares 1985 to current?
Yeah, no problem.
I just had a quick question about that.
Right there. That's exhibit A55.
Yeah. I mean, I noticed that the road network shown on the 1985 is exactly the same as current. Is that just an overlay of the current road network? I'm just trying to accurately, compare the development in both pictures. And
It is, Mr. Examiner. Yeah, those are my my images, and they so it is, it's just an overlay on Google Earth. So
Okay.
it's
Yeah, because I couldn't
you're
tell if those are actual roads or okay. All right. That
yeah
thank you.
you're correct to note. I should have turned that layer off.
Okay. I got it. Great. Thank you. All right. Sorry, Ms. Koloskova, to interrupt. Go ahead.
Thank you. We can go ahead and pull it. Thanks. Perfect. What time is it? Good morning, Mr. Rosine. Good afternoon to you.
Good morning, Mrs. Koloskova.
I represent the project applicant in this matter. I don't think we've met before, so it's very
Nice
nice
to
to meet
meet
you.
you. Nice to meet you as well. I actually went to school in Bellevue, went to an early high school.
Very good. Very
Grew up
good.
down
On
the
the
road.
road.
Newport High School myself. So
All right.
there you go.
All right, you guys, I'm going to admit that I went to Mercer Island in the
Oh, God.
70s.
All
So,
right.
oh, God. All right. Can we not do
Okay.
that?
That was it.
Those children's of the 70s and the 80s
Yeah,
of this
I
area.
get it.
Yes, I think we can stipulate the area has changed quite a bit since then.
Definitely.
Mr. Rosine, I want to understand a little bit about your background, just to clarify. As I understand, you are testifying as a hydrological expert on behalf of the Friends of Island Lake. Is that correct?
Yeah, I think I would broaden that to say water resources engineering expert. Yeah.
Okay. Are you a licensed hydrogeologist?
I am not.
Okay. Do you know whether there's a licensure for hydrogeology in Washington State?
That's a good question. I suspect that there is. Yeah.
Okay. And is there one in New England?
There is. Yeah. It's
Okay.
a professional licensure. Yeah, that's right.
But you don't have a licensure in any jurisdiction for that.
That's correct.
Okay.
But that said, stormwater engineers, we use, wetlands, hydrogeology, soils, structural, geotech, all the above. So, I'm familiar with most of that to a fairly good degree.
Have you ever called on a licensed hydrogeologist to support a project?
Yes.
And are you a licensed professional engineer in Washington State?
I am not.
Okay. And are you familiar? I'm just curious, are you familiar? But you are licensed, I'm sorry, in New England, correct?
Correct, yes.
Okay. So again, your role here is not under a particular licensure for this state, correct?
That's correct.
Okay. I assume we probably have to be a little bit careful then. I don't know what the rules are. I guess I don't know what the rules are in terms of licensure and expert testimony in a state if you're not licensed. Have you looked at that?
I have, yeah. I've actually, I've
I
worked,
don't want to get you in trouble. I
at,
not run into it.
yeah. No, I've actually been hired to review Department of Ecology's permits by various groups before. So I practice in Washington. I don't stamp drawings in Washington for sure.
Did you perform a hydrogeologic review for this project?
I did, yes.
Okay. Did you submit that into the record?
I have not.
Okay. So I don't have a copy of that that I could ask you about, do I?
No. No, I'm in the process of preparing a comment letter that will be submitted at some point here
A comment letter on what?
on what we're hearing. There's a comment letter, the comment period that ends, I believe, 7 days after the hearing or 7 days after something or other.
Okay. Were you aware of any deadlines related to expert reports for this project?
I haven't prepared an expert report.
And are you a critical, are you, do you have any license, any licensing in biology, wetland or critical areas biology or ecology?
Licensing, no. Training, yes. Yeah. Certainly my background includes lots of ecology. Yeah. So I could be, a professional wetland scientist, I already have alphabet soup behind my name, and so I don't do that. I haven't done that.
So that's not okay. That's not central to this piece.
All right.
You testified a fair bit on a couple documents, and I'm not going to ask you about the documents, but I just want to give you the numbers Exhibit A28, which was related to the 303D listing streams. Do you recall that document?
I believe so, yeah.
Okay.
Is it,
Do
are
you?
you referring to the one that Mr. Telegin
Yes.
showed?
Yep,
Yes, thank
that's
you. Yeah.
correct. Yep, that's right. Do you know whether that was information that was available to public knowledge that would have been available to Kitsap County over the last, I guess, 30 years that you were testifying about?
Yes, of yeah, absolutely. This is yeah, that comes out of a state database.
Okay.
And I don't recall quite what that database was that Mr. Telegin showed, but I believe it's a I believe it's a Department of Ecology. Generally speaking, each state has to post all of that as a requirement by EPA.
Okay. And materials like that, are those materials that ecology, I'm going to ask you just very generally, are those the types of materials that the Department of Ecology takes into account when it's developing stormwater manuals and those sorts of considerations?
100%. Yeah, absolutely. It's largely the driver. Those two pieces are hand in glove.
Okay. I don't have a lot of questions for you. I just do want to clear up a couple
Please, yeah.
things.
Oh, yeah. Take your time.
Did I hear you correctly? I wrote this down. What the Washington Stormwater Manual is one of the best in the country. Is that, did I? Okay, thanks.
I
That's
mean,
great. That's great.
It was also
That's
partially qualified. It is one
good.
of the best in the country, and when fully implemented,
Yes.
it's phenomenal.
Awesome. Okay. And by the way, you're also not a geotechnical expert, are you?
I am not, no.
Okay.
Although I do a lot of geotech in my practice, a lot. But if
But
it,
you
if it,
would, I presume, rely on a licensed geotechnical expert to actually do your soils analysis, correct?
I think it would depend on the project. So no, not always. As a matter of routine, a lot of this information does not require a geotechnical engineer. So it's so an example on the projects that I design fairly routinely. There's a variety of sources of soil. So maybe it came from a geotechnical engineer, maybe it came from the state database. It depends on what the application is. For stormwater infiltration, probably not a geotechnical engineer. For roads and building foundations, yes, a geotechnical engineer.
Do you know in Washington State, is it common to use a geotechnical engineer to perform analysis in order to develop a stormwater plan for a project?
I think it is common.
Okay. Another clarification, you testified, did you testify, sorry, that the district pumps around 30 million gallons of water into Island Lake a year?
Yes.
Okay. And do I understand correctly that the district regulates the level of the lake and uses that water to regulate lake levels?
No, I don't think that's quite how it works. I think the lake levels are sort of independent. They're just sort of a natural process. And when the lake is under stress, the water district supplements with pumped water. What you're describing there would be a more typical lake environment where water's flowing in from a stream, on one side, and then you have a regulated outfall on the end. But that's not what we have here, and that's why we've heard many times people testify that it's rare that water actually flows out from the lake into Barker Creek.
Okay, but I guess I do understand correctly that the purpose of putting 30 million gallons of water into the lake each year is in order to address lake levels. Is that
Oh,
right?
yeah, 1,000%. Yeah, sorry if I
Thank you.
misunderstood you there.
Okay. And have you measured the project's propose? I guess the effect. What the groundwater recharge level impacts would be of this project to Island Lake.
I have not. I've just reviewed the applicant materials.
And have you had an opportunity to look at the outlet from Island Lake to Barker Creek?
I have not been to the site, so from that standpoint, I have not even had my feet on the ground. Do I understand what the outlet is like? Yeah, a bit. I mean, I've read about it. Yeah, I understand that it's yeah. So I wouldn't need to go into that, but yeah, I'd be happy to elaborate on my level of understanding if that's helpful.
Do you know whether there's a flow restrictor there?
I know that there's a flow restrictor there when it gets to a certain level, and it rarely gets to that level.
Okay. Do you know what level that is?
Not off the top of my head. I don't think, yeah, I
That's okay.
don't
I don't need
remember.
you to speculate. I'm
I
just
think
trying to
it's
understand
around
the sort
217
of
or
scope
something,
of what you've
218,
looked at.
something like that.
Okay. Do you know who regulates or controls that flow restrictor?
I don't. I would assume that's a Silverdale Water District, but I don't know.
Okay. So I guess then you wouldn't know whether the ground, I guess the change to water going into Island Lake would make a difference in terms of that flow restrictor and when it would be, I guess when water would go high enough to flow into Barker Creek then, because you haven't looked at that math.
No, I think I would have an understanding of that. So I mean, it's basic. So I don't remember the exact specifics because my understanding was that it doesn't happen or happens very, very irregularly.
Okay.
But that it's going to flow out when it gets to a certain stage, which is very common. It rarely gets to that stage, and it can be released at lower levels. However, there would be no, at this point in time, there would be no reason why anybody would do that because they're trying to do the exact opposite. They're trying to maintain minimum levels in the lake, so there'd be no reason for them to release water to Barker Creek.
Okay.
Meaning that those two things are antagonistic, they're counterproductive.
And they is who?
I'm assuming that's Silverdale Water District. I mean, it would make sense. I don't know that
We
to
don't.
be the case exactly, but it would make sense that the person, the entity that's supplying water would also be the entity that could withdraw that would release water. Otherwise,
So, I
one hand
mean,
arguing with the other.
am I fair to say that the level of Island Lake is almost sort of artificially controlled by the district because it can add water when it decides that's consistent with its plans?
I don't think I would say artificially controlled. It's supplemented, right? In what
Supplement.
so
Okay.
the level of the lake is not a man-made or a person-made lake here, right?
Understood.
Although actually it could be. I don't actually know the history of it, and that's a very common thing. But but let's say that the lake appears to be naturally fed, a groundwater fed lake. But we're kind of getting a little beyond my understanding. But I can say that what I understand in the area, generally speaking, is we have a sand deposit over ice contact materials, and we have lenses, and that it's either we're at the bottom of a lens or we're on a perched lens or some variation on that. I did read a study, and I can't remember which one it was, that described the thought that the bottom of the lake may be higher than the aquifer, but that the distance between the bottom of the lake or the water level in the lake and the aquifer itself relates to the leakage rate. So that these two, regardless of whether it's feeding it directly or not, the water level of the lake and the water level of the aquifer are absolutely related, and they contribute to each other.
Okay. And again, the district adds water
Yes.
up to $30 million,
Yeah.
thirty
I believe
million
the high one's
gallons,
around 33. Yeah.
lawyers, thirty
Yeah.
million gallons of water to
Right.
address those sorts of discrepancies. Okay.
That's right. That's
Thank
right.
you.
Exactly.
Thank you. Okay. Yeah, let's see. You are not a geotech, so I will not ask you about soils. And I understand you may come back on other topics. So I may be done with my questions. I'm done. Thank you very much.
Okay, let
Thank
me
you for your
before we
time.
get to Ms. Nickel, let me address the post-hearing comment issue. I think I could fairly accommodate everyone on this point. I mean, when Mr. Telgen brought this up, that the hearing notice has this boilerplate 7-day post-hearing comment, I was taking a little, I was a little surprised by that. I didn't know that the county does that. And Ms. Jones said that's just been historical practice of the county. And I had said, sure, yeah, you know, if it's in the notice, we'll go with that. My understanding was that was going to be for just a public comment. I didn't realize that would include expert testimony. That does bring up the problem of Crowbrook versus Snohomish County, which holds that there's a right of cross-examination for expert testimony in a land use hearing. So I think just a way to kind of deal with that particular issue, I'm going to provisionally, when we get to the end of the hearing, schedule a date for any cross-examination that people may request for any expert testimony that comes in post-hearing comment. And I just ask the parties, you know, when those written comments come in from any experts, if you want a right to cross-examination, you know, let us know by email within 24 hours. That's the case, and then we'll schedule it for that date. But I think in order to both accommodate the hearing notice and the Crowbuck at the same time, that's probably the best way to handle it. So.
I will lodge an objection, Mr. Examiner, knowing it's likely going to be overruled, but the parties agreed upon an exchange of expert witness materials. We complied with that, and the SEPA, or pardon me, the Friends Group never indicated any inability to either comply with that date. And in fact, Mr. Rosine was readily disclosed as a witness. And since we've submitted our materials, there's been another almost month, or well, there will be, have been almost a month by the time this hearing's done. So I guess I'm deeply concerned about this sort of ongoing use of experts outside of the SEPA scenario. So, and I certainly would object to any belated expert witness reports now when there was absolutely no indication that there was any problem or inability to comply with those deadlines that we all agreed to. So I guess the use of this plat in order to address SEPA issues, I would object to that.
Yeah, Mr. Telton, you want to address that?
Yeah, I mean, so I guess we're trying to do what we can, first of all. And so a couple points. So what Mr. Rosian talked about was the comments we intend to submit on the SCUP and the preliminary plat, right? And I get that there can be disputes about what is a SEPA issue, what is a not SEPA issue. But as I recall, on the very first day of the hearing, when we had the public hearing, you know, often, you know, I've experienced examiners telling people, you know, don't raise this issue because that, you know, because that's a SEPA issue. Well, that'll be addressed separately. But you affirmatively said, Mr. Examiner, that this case, because the approval criteria for the permits are so broad, I mean, really impact is relevant. That's relevant under one is relevant under another. And so we have been trying to prepare our comments on the preliminary plat and the SCUP, and we've been doing that in good faith based on the notice that was sent out saying that comments would be due ultimately 7 days after that hearing. And I would say that what we've seen in the arc of this proceeding so far, at least, is the county first saying a hydrological study needs to be done, and then it didn't happen. And then we got it. We did get a study on December 17th.
December 13th.
Oh, okay. Addressing that was submitted as a rebuttal document, which was the
No.
very first.
No, I have to clarify that. We submitted that document as part of our materials. There were no rebuttal documents submitted in response to that, nor even a reservation that the SEPA appellants planned to provide a rebuttal document. So this is, in fact, quite a surprise because the Friends Group asked for a hydrology report. They have had weeks to submit a responsive document. And now what I'm hearing is that the plat process will be used to submit a responsive hydrology report that is responding to a SEPA appeal document. That is a huge concern for procedural concern that I would have, particularly where the examiner then is suggesting that I would be cross-examining a SEPA-based expert during the plat when cross-examination isn't even usually used during a plat. Nor has there been any explanation as to why this material couldn't have been submitted in a timely fashion to begin with. There's no prejudice indicated here.
But I'm confused. Just 1 second. I was looking for something. But I apologize. I've been very tired lately.
Well,
I'm sorry, this is
let's.
embarrassing. I'm having a head problem right now.
I can take a break. We can take a
Yeah,
break.
I'm sorry. I suddenly.
You want to take a break, Mr. Television? That's
Yeah,
fine. Yeah, let's do that.
suddenly I don't feel well. I'm sorry.
Okay, definitely. Okay, let's take at least 15 to 11:50
Do
then.
you want to stay on, Mr. Television? Should we stay on video?
I don't know.
I'm going to stay on video. Brian, I'm staying on video. Can we just keep maybe the attorneys on video for a moment, please?
Would you like me to stop the recording for now and then resume at the next? Okay, perfect.